Good morning. I'm Peter Donalds, in for Kathleen Dunn this hour, and I welcome you to the program. What we're going to be talking about this hour is climate change, among other things, environmental, because our guest is Jim Motovalli, editor of E! Magazine and author of Feeling the Heat, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Change. And he's written an article in the recent current issue of E! The Can-Do Congress. With Democratic control comes a flood of climate and energy initiatives. So we're going to find out from our guest if that is indeed true, if we will be seeing, certainly the legislation is in play, but none of it has been passed yet, and we'll see what the future of that is. So this hour, the politics in the U.S. of climate change, and will the new Democratic Congress have something to say as the legislative calendar continues? Our guest also was a participant in yesterday's 300-mile test drive of the Chevy Sequel, a new hydrogen fuel cell prototype, and the test drive happened yesterday, and we'll ask him about that. So plenty to talk about in the way of the environment this hour. You can join us at 800-486-8655, or if you're in Milwaukee, the local number 414-227-2050. Once again, the toll-free 800-486-8655. Jim Motovalli, welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Great to be on.
So I want to talk about a lot of things this hour. Let's start, though, with your article and the legislation. There are several bills in play. Why don't you give us a short laundry list of the ones you think are most likely to we'll be reading about here in the near future?
Well, I think the most effective one is the one currently known as Sanders Boxer, sponsored by Barbara Boxer, and originally James Jeffords of Vermont, but he has since stepped down, and Bernie Sanders has his seat in the Senate. He's independent from Vermont. So it's Barbara Boxer from California and Bernie Sanders from Vermont. And that would do a whole lot to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. It would cap them at 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. And there's a companion bill to that in the House, introduced by Congressman Henry Waxman of California, called the Safe Climate Act. It has pretty similar provisions. That would probably be the most far-reaching legislation for Congress to enact. But there are a number of alternatives, including John Kerry of Massachusetts, Olympia Snow of Maine, so you can call that a bipartisan bill. They have the Global Warming Reduction Act, and that would cap emissions at 65% of 2000 levels by 2050.
Boy, it's been a long time since we've heard these names as titles of bills.
Kerry, that had a chance of passage.
Yeah, Kerry Waxman, Bernie Sanders, of all people.
Yeah,
I wonder if they remember how to do it.
Well, of course, there's also the fairly long-standing bill that was recently revised, called the Climate Stewardship and Innovation Act, and that's John McCain and Joseph Lieberman. It's interesting to see if McCain will backpedal on climate change when he's running for president. He's holding fast on Iraq. I don't know what his thoughts on climate change are these days. I haven't heard him say much about it. But that bill was recently toughened up, and it is now stronger. It now requires that emissions be reduced to 2004 levels by 2012 and 1990 levels by 2020, and 60% below 1990 by 2050. I'm sorry if all those numbers are confusing. And another provision of the McCain-Lieberman bill is it has a lot of subsidies in it for nuclear power, because there's an interesting backlash going on with some environmentalists now saying they want to take a second look at nuclear power because it does not produce climate emissions. And it's pretty, I should say, heated debate right now. I'd say still the majority of environmentalists are opposed to nuclear power, but it's increasingly looking like there are not a lot of other great energy alternatives. And I always say to people, you have to be for some form of energy. If you expect the lights to come on and the heat to work, you've got to basically bite the bullet, because there's negatives to almost every form of energy, even wind power. And I'd like to see people having a more practical view of energy needs, and sometimes that means endorsing something that's not 100% clean.
Let's getting back to these bills just for a moment. I don't want to get too tied up in this, but of all these bills, do you see them as competing legislation, or will these legislators get together and fashion maybe one or two bills out of this sort of mungle right now?
It seems likely that there would eventually be some kind of compromise, and that the two houses of Congress would unite around one or the other of these bills, and maybe include some provisions of the other ones in a united bill. It's possible, and it's quite likely they'll be watered down a bit too.
Yeah.
So I do see something like that happening. With it being an election year, I don't know, but there was talk that one of these bills would be coming up on the House and Senate floor by Labor Day, which would be definitely a good thing given the urgency of this situation.
I was going to ask you about the timetable, and yeah, the effect of the presidential campaign, which we're already well into, is will these bills, if and when they're passed, will they be signed by the president? I know we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but I'm just kind of looking ahead. Do they have a chance of really coming through? Coming around all four bases here, and B, will they be meaningful?
I think the best of them will be very meaningful and really actually take us a fair amount of where we need to be, because I think the next two or three years is really critical in addressing climate change, as we're reaching this sort of tipping point in concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, after which it's really an unknown what would happen. And, you know, sort of pushing back from the brink in the next 2 years is pretty important. Whether Bush would sign it, my guess is he wouldn't, unless, particularly with him in lame duck status, and the fact that he hasn't really shown much willingness to compromise on anything, even in the face of really bad poll numbers, my guess is he would veto one of these bills, and Congress would have to be pretty united to override that veto.
So
I hope that would be what would happen.
So I guess then what you're saying is that makes this even a larger issue in the presidential campaign.
Yeah, and I would say that almost every presidential candidate, with the possible exception of Sam Brownback, believes that climate change is an issue. I mean, Bush is extremely isolated on that, even among Republican candidates for president. I mean, I would say, John McCain, for instance, has a pretty good view of climate change. He's very, very conservative on other things, but on this issue, he recognizes the need for legislation and the need for action, and I think most of the other Republicans do too.
And there are really three levels we're talking about here. Right now, we're just talking about the U.S. federal level, but there are also, of course, the state level, where Governor Schwarzenegger has made a lot of news and what he's doing in California. And then there's the international level with the new UN reports coming out on a regular basis. Kyoto is still there. I'm not sure where. So I guess my question to you is this the right federal legislation you feel is necessary? How do you feel the role is for both the state level and the international level playing into what we're talking about here in Congress?
Well, I think it's really vital, particularly given Bush's refusal to move on the issue, that the states take it up, and not just the states, but regional compacts of the states, because we've had like the New England states. If you look at the states that have signed on to the California emissions law, and I don't know why Wisconsin is not one of them. It would be sure good if it was. If you look at the states that have signed them on, they're almost like regional compacts, because you have the whole West Coast, all the West Coast states, and pretty much all of New England acting as sort of blocks to endorse California emissions. And you also have separate regional compacts and statewide efforts, as well as efforts by, as an example, the Seattle mayor, Greg Nickels, has organized other mayors to basically endorse Kyoto, do an end run around Bush. And the last I checked, there was like 400 or 500 mayors that had signed that. promising to endorse Kyoto locally. And I think that's really important.
Where does Kyoto stand right now?
Well, Kyoto is implemented, but I think a lot of the signers of it are not going to actually meet their Kyoto targets. The only big holdouts to Kyoto are the United States and Australia among the industrialized countries. And I would think that Australia looks ready to move on it, particularly if they have a new Labor government. Actually, believe it or not, their new environmental minister is likely to be Peter Garrett, who was the lead singer of Midnight Oil, and is extremely committed to taking action on climate change.
And a Democratic president in 2008, if that were to happen, would that have any impact on, or is Kyoto dead in America?
Well, I think we basically have to look beyond Kyoto now and to some kind of new international agreement that's a lot stronger than Kyoto. Kyoto, people should realize, is just a toe in the water of what needs to be done internationally to address climate change. It would not by itself forestall climate change. We can't just enact Kyoto and have that be it. I don't think people realize really the magnitude of the challenge we face. It basically means giving up on fossil fuels, and I don't think the reality of that has really sunk in too much. You mentioned that I was driving a hydrogen-powered car, and we can get into that later. I was doing that yesterday. But we need to look at alternatives to fossil fuels. We need to have a complete change in our energy economy. That's what the kind of magnitude of what we need to do.
Well, let's go ahead and go there then. The technology, many say, is just not ready for that. We are going to be oil dependent for the foreseeable future. Do you disagree with that?
Well, it depends on how you define foreseeable future. I think within my lifetime, we're going to be basically getting out of fossil fuels. Of course, that depends on how old I am, right?
And how well you're taking care of yourself.
That's right. I think I will be driving an alternative-fueled car at some point in my life, and as will most of your listeners. We cannot simply afford to... If you look at just China as an example, and the number of cars likely to go on the road in China in the next 10 years, and the increase every year, energy demand around the world increases 2 or 3%. That is business as usual, and many countries, many developing countries, are motorizing and building highways, and they want what we have. They want super highways, and they want private car ownership. And until now, if you look at the per capita climate output of the average person in China or in Africa, it's very small. The United States is 25 to 30% of the climate change contribution, even though we're only 5% of the world's population. But China, for instance, will surpass the U.S. in terms of global warming production.
Did I read correctly? I think in your article that the pace at which they're adding cars to the road will double the world population of automobiles?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It'll go over a billion. And right now it's like 600 million. So, I think that's likely to happen. And there's absolutely no way, given what we know about climate, that all those cars can be just normal internal combustion engines with tailpipes. We simply do not have the climate luxury of that. It'll be thrusting the world into a complete unknown in terms of global warming response. We already know what all the things that are happening in terms of what we've done already on climate, but this is a whole other ball game that we'd be getting into.
Well, let's take a quick break and then pick up on that, and I'll ask you about your test drive in the hydrogen car yesterday.
Sure.
All right, we're talking with Jim Motovalli. He's editor of E! Magazine and author of Feeling the Heat, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Climate Change. He also was the test driver of a Chevy Sequel, a hydrogen-fueled car, yesterday, and we're going to talk about that when we come back. Your calls certainly invited right now, 800-486-8655. That's toll-free, of course, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, you can dial us locally at 414-227-2050. Peter Donald's here in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking the environment today, environmental policy, energy use. The new Democratic Congress has some ideas for you, and we'll see if they take any action here in the next few weeks, months. And also, we left before the break talking about the new hydrogen-fueled car. It's called the Chevy Sequel, and our guest this hour was a test driver yesterday, Jim Motovalli, editor of E! Magazine. Jim, how did the drive go?
Well, it was very successful. They had two hydrogen-powered Sequel cars. This is the state-of-the-art, pretty much, with hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. And we drove them from Rochester, New York, to Tarrytown, New York, which is about 300 miles. And both of them made it there. As a matter of fact, they thought that they could probably go 350 miles, given the amount of hydrogen that was left. And I'd say this is a milestone, because 300 miles is about what consumers expect of their vehicles to be able to do. I think one of the big reasons that electric cars failed in the marketplace, and I disagree with that film, Who Killed the Electric Car, which has its own conclusions about that. But the main reason they failed, I think, was the range issue, because the average electric battery car would only go about 90 miles before needing to plug in again. And these hydrogen cars, which are sort of like battery cars, if you think about taking the batteries out and putting in a fuel cell instead, because they both have electric motors, and basically that's what they are, is electric cars. But the fuel cell has the power to give a range of 300 miles to the vehicle. And I think consumers would find the Chevy Sequel, as an example, to be a very good automobile that would have high levels of consumer acceptability, because it's really fast. It's incredibly quiet. It's got lots of space. It's essentially an SUV that doesn't make much noise at all.
And other automakers are also working on hydrogen
prototypes? Most prominently Honda, and mm-hmm. I drove the Honda fuel cell car, the FCX, last week down in Washington, and that's come a long way also. That has a 270-mile range, so at least theoretically it does. And I think the cars themselves are getting really close to what consumers could really get behind.
So how far are we from seeing hydrogen cars on the road, and what needs to happen?
Well, I did a piece on this in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, but you have to look at the infrastructure questions with hydrogen. It's why it's still something like 15 to 20 years away, because you have to, A, make both the cars and the hydrogen itself affordable, and then you have to figure a way of getting it into gas stations. Right now we have 180,000 gas stations in the U.S., and something like 60,000 of them would probably have to have hydrogen. I was talking to the vice president of General Motors, Larry Burns, yesterday, and he thought you could do it with a lot less, maybe 15,000 stations with hydrogen. But that's still a fairly big leap. Also, we have to be able to produce hydrogen cheaper rates. You can either reform it from natural gas, or you can produce it through electrolysis of water. Both of these processes are pretty well established, but because of high electricity prices, electrolysis is kind of expensive. And because of high natural gas prices, reformation from natural gas is expensive too. So both of these methods right now are producing hydrogen for the equivalent of about $3 to $8 a gallon. It depends on how you do it. And as gas prices go up, that becomes more and more attractive. Plus, you can make hydrogen from renewables like wind and solar power. And that is actually getting cheaper. As the price of doing it from natural gas goes up, the price of doing it from wind, for example, goes down. And that's really great, because you can end up having a totally clean energy loop if you produce hydrogen from wind power.
Mm-hmm. We got a couple of issues on the table here, and a lot of people want to talk to you, so let's get to callers. Well, talking, as you just heard, about the future of hydrogen-fueled vehicles, and also our guest this hour, Jim Motovalli, wrote a piece in E! Magazine regarding the new Democratic Congress and what legislation they may be presenting to the American people in the way of climate change and energy policy. So those and other items on the table regarding energy, and your calls welcome at 800-486-8655. We go first to Colleen. Hi, Colleen. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if the time has come to reintroduce the idea of fuel rationing.
That's an interesting one. You know what I find really regressive that I've seen posited lately in state legislatures is the idea of removing the gas tax. And demagogic state reps are always bringing that up, and that is a really bad idea. It temporarily lowers the price of gasoline at the pumps, but it does nothing to discourage the gas companies from the oil companies from raising their prices. And I think we might eventually get to fuel rationing. Right now, the problem isn't supply of oil. It's not like 1974 when there were gas lines and rationing by default, I guess you could say. We have plenty of it, but there's two things going on. One is that we're reaching peak oil, and that's causing the price to go up because there isn't as much supply. There's demand chasing not as much supply. And there's also, in my mind, and I think in the American people's mind, judging by polls I've seen, incredible price gouging by the oil companies. I mean, how many times do we have to see that they've made record profits every year? And with the Bush administration bending over backwards to accommodate them at every turn, it's no wonder that they're making those profit announcements. But the American people are quite aware of that, and I think they want some action on energy. Whether gas rationing is the best way to do it, that might be my first choice. I would look more towards a carbon tax and also legislation to prevent price gouging by oil companies.
Colleen, thanks for your call. The peak of peak oil seems to just keep moving and moving.
Depends on who you ask. Some people think we've already passed the peak of oil.
Yeah. I guess it's just there are competing interests here. One is that we want to use less gas for the sake of fewer emissions, and yet then that has economic implications. If supplies are held back, then the price goes up. So there's this relationship between price and supply.
Yes.
That muddies the waters when we're trying to do something about emissions.
Well, also, I think people need to understand that peak oil is not the end of oil. It's not like the oil runs out at peak oil. It simply means that there's more demand than there is supply. And I think that is creates pressure upward on oil prices. And I don't think we're in a temporary situation with that, because $3.50 oil is not all price gouging. A lot of it is just the inevitable forces on the spot market where a lot of oil is traded. And the oil we have left in the ground, which is probably half of the historic supply, is just harder to get, costs more to get, is more environmentally challenging. There's a lot of different reasons why that would be causing pressure on pricing.
What did you think about President Bush's statement earlier this week on emissions and fuel efficiency?
Well, I think he's basically trying to. He said there wouldn't be any action on emissions and fuel economy until the end of 2008, which is effectively to the end of his presidency.
Uh-huh.
So he's obviously just stalling. And the Supreme Court ruled that he was supposed to take action on regulating carbon dioxide emissions, and he's obviously not going to do that until right at the end of his presidency, if at all.
Someone in the Oval Office just say, "Hey, Mr. President, the Supreme Court decision, we still haven't said anything about that. We need to at least make a statement."
I think as long as Dick Cheney is vice president, and as long as President Bush listens very closely to what he has to say, we will not have action on climate change in that presidency.
Okay, and
no matter what the Supreme Court says, and no matter what he's ordered to do.
Yeah, Steele is calling from Appleton. Hi, Steele.
Hello. I'm worried about the push for ethanol E85. I saw a gas station here in town selling it for $2.85, and the price is $3.25. But all the extra cost in it kind of worries me. And then just a quickie on mindset. New York Times and some of the papers talk about their little 36-hour getaways and jet away to here and there and have a good time. And anyway, kind of the opinion on ethanol.
Well, I'm of two minds on ethanol. I'm not a fan of corn-based ethanol. I think it's basically a political thing that benefits Midwestern senators, probably including some of Wisconsin's senators, because farmers benefit from it. And it's essentially, to me, it's a subsidy for farmers to grow corn. I think there are other problems with it. I think the amount of energy you get out of it compared to the amount of energy you put in it makes it a very dicey proposition. However, I would say, and this is what I'm talking about, E85 ethanol from corn. If you look at the promise of cellulosic ethanol, I think most people would agree that is worth investigating because the amount of energy you get out of it is much greater, and we don't necessarily have to rely on food crops for it. We can get it from switchgrass is the most prominent example, but any plant that's rich in cellulose could be producing lots of ethanol. And we can look at Brazil as a model because the Brazilians produce ethanol from sugarcane, which is a lot closer. The process for making it from sugarcane is very efficient. And they also use, it's sort of a closed loop because they use the waste of the sugarcane, which is called bagasse, as the raw material for the process. And in effect, they burn the bagasse and that fires the ethanol process. And they have very affordable ethanol on the market in Brazil, and they even export it to countries like Sweden. And that's not, cellulosic ethanol actually has more promise than that. But I think we could even develop a sugar-based ethanol industry in Florida that could be very competitive, at least regionally. And we really do need to look at cellulosic ethanol. And right now, it's still in its infancy. I basically see that we have, going ahead, there's not one energy solution. It's not necessarily hydrogen and that's it. It's not necessarily ethanol and that's it. It's not biodiesel and that's it. It's sort of a smorgasbord of all these things. And as I mentioned, I was talking to Larry Burns of GM, and that's basically what he sees also.
Does the new legislation in Congress we're talking about that's working its way through, does that reflect that philosophy as well, that there's innovation and a variety of solutions?
Well, I think in a way this is one of the few areas where I think Bush has actually got it right on energy and climate in at least paying lip service to some of these new technologies like cellulosic ethanol. However, he has not really funded it to any great degree. And while he's made big announcements about that, about I think it was like $1.5 billion for alternative energy research, in effect, he was talking about a lot of existing programs, and he was really pledging very little money to it. I think we need something akin to a Manhattan Project to develop these new fuels. We need to really put a lot of effort into it. If we took even a fraction of what we're spending on the Iraq war and devoted it to this, I think we would come up with energy solutions that would be very long-lasting and effective. But it's going to take a commitment of a lot more than just a few little show projects. This is the biggest issue confronting mankind in the 21st century. So we really got to take it seriously and not get distracted by Paris Hilton and all the other background noise.
you'd like to see the next president stand up as John Kennedy did and say we're going to put a man on the moon within 10 years. Make that weighty of a statement.
Yeah, it actually has to come to that. I mean, it can't just be an applause line in the State of the Union address, and then it's Bush was actually making these pledges at the same time he was cutting programs at the National Renewable Energy Lab, and that administration has made no great commitment to alternative fuels, and I think that's what we need.
Have you heard
climate and fuels bill?
Have you heard anything that you like from any of the candidates on either side yet?
Oh, yeah. If you look at what Barack Obama recently committed to a 40-mile-per-gallon corporate average fuel economy, and that would be really great. They all say pretty good things, and they're all backing various climate bills. So, in the breach, you have to look at the Clinton-Gore administration and wonder why they didn't do more in office. And if I have a complaint about Al Gore, I actually hope he does run for president. But during his vice presidency, I don't think he did nearly enough to push energy initiatives and to, admittedly, he had a pretty hostile Congress, but I think he could have done more to get climate legislation enacted and Kyoto passed than he did. He didn't push as hard as he should have.
Speaking of Al Gore, I think you also wrote about, or someone did, I was reading this morning, about Gore's recent troubles being revealed that his large estate was a big energy gulper. And however you fault him on that, it did sort of raise the issue that I know you've talked about, and that is, can you be both big and green?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's very important that, when you have a star, take Leonardo DiCaprio, and people tend to celebrate when he says he owns a hybrid car or something like that. But I think you have to look at other aspects of their life. If they own 10 other cars, then I don't think they're the greenest person on earth. Also, if they're living in some 50,000 square foot mansion, even if it has solar panels on the roof, I don't think that's all that green either. If you ask me, the only fully green movie star is Ed Begley Jr., who lives a very modest, small life with very much concern about the amount of energy he uses.
And movie stars aside for a moment, as each of us makes our individual decisions about how we want to leave a smaller footprint, that's something to take into consideration, isn't it? We talked about it earlier. The sort of way of life has been a phrase that's been around for a long time now. And you said yourself, it's going to take a very different sort of way of life, isn't it?
Yeah, I think people have to look at all aspects of their life. Think about downsizing in various ways. I'm probably guilty of it as much as the other person. But I've been trying to live a greener life, and I get a lot of flack from my family about things like putting in compact fluorescent bulbs.
It seems like we're still, as much as we like to say we're at this tipping point, boy, just I know in my personal life, I still come up a lot of people, family and friends, who just sort of mock me or laugh at me if I mention any of this.
Oh, yeah, and I would say that was true for me, too, because I don't think people are really taking it seriously. They think that's just some private obsession you have, but it's not really all that pressing. And people have never put environmental issues like at the center of their lives. And that, I think, is what's going to happen in the 21st century. All the big issues to me are environmental issues, and some of them may look like something else, but I think they will shape up as environmental issues. This is definitely the environmental century, and the growing interest in environmental issues now, I think, is a sign of that, because I think people are beginning to wake up on the issue. But I think it's nothing compared to what we have to do and what the emphasis we're going to put on these issues moving forward. I don't think we have any alternative.
Let's talk with Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Morning, Jim. One of the issues that I noticed that everybody seems to skirt around is population growth. I don't think we'd have any of these issues that we're currently facing if we still had the population of the post-World War II, around 2 billion. We're up above 6 billion now. In 40 years, we'll be double the population across the world, 10, 12 billion. Your guest mentioned a yearly increase in energy of 2 to 3%, so 2.5% a year. In 40 years, we're looking at double the amount of energy. Until we control the Earth's population, we talk about cutting back. It's a tough issue to talk about. Even Al Gore in The Inconvenient Truth, he just touched on the subject, but he wouldn't go into depth about it because people are very uncomfortable talking about population control. You've got a passage in the Bible that says, "Thou shalt be fruitful and multiply." Well, we're just going to strip the resources of this earth to the point where you know, we will defoliate and use up all of the energy that's available to us if we don't control our runaway population.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I agree with you 100%, everything you just said. And you're right that it makes a lot of people uncomfortable. But if you look at climate issues, if you look at energy issues, if you look at resource issues, they are all at their heart population issues. And I think environmental groups that try to not get involved in population issues because it makes them uncomfortable or they worry about losing members, I think that's a total cop-out. And not only do you have to get involved in, and this is what really makes people uncomfortable, if you look at United States population, it's almost 100% fueled, or population growth, it's mostly fueled by immigration, because the U.S. would have zero population growth were it not for very heavy and very unprecedented levels of immigration of about 1 million legal immigrants a year. And to me, all the debate of people like Lou Dobbs, which is very focused on illegal immigrants and border issues and all that, that to me is a little beside the point. I think you have to look at what our legal immigration numbers are and how we got to this point. At a point when most Americans in polls say they would like to see immigration reduced, we still have very high immigration levels, and it is fueling massive population growth in the United States at a time when other countries are actually experiencing what they call birth dearth. Most of the developing or the developed world, if you include all of Western Europe, Russia, and Japan, are in actual population shrinkage at this point. It actually could be a problem in Western Europe and Japan because of how rapidly they're losing population. Even Mexico, and this is something I've hardly ever seen mentioned, is got population fertility rates that are probably around replacement or below replacement level. The U.S. has replacement level fertility too, but because of high immigration, we actually will be doubling our population. And I don't think we're having a national debate about what we want American population growth to be and what we want American population to stabilize at, because I think all of our energy gains, all of our fuel efficiency and conservation gains can be wiped out by dramatic population growth. And that's right now is what we're on a path to do. So I would totally agree with that caller.
Mike, thanks very much for the call. Quick break and then right back with our guest. I'm Peter Donalds in for Kathleen Dunn. Peter Donalds here in for Kathleen Dunn. Our guest, Jim Motovalli, editor of E! Magazine, author of the article, The Can-Do Congress, With Democratic Control Comes a Flood of Climate and Energy Initiatives. We're talking about that among other general questions of energy and environment. You know, Jim, Mike got me thinking here that there is sort of that the problem behind the problem. You sort of deconstruct the problem and you find root causes. I know often in our conversations here, political corruption, and then, well, the real reason is campaign reform is needed. And then one level back, well, if we had media reform, then the public would know what's going on. You know what I'm saying about sort of tiered problems? And,
yeah.
And Mike seems to put that into our minds here with the environmental issues. Maybe you tear that back a layer, and it's population. And as you mentioned, population is leveling off in developed countries, and we hear time and time again that the way to control population is not by passing a law a la you know China and Mao, but to increase women's rights and education around the globe. So
well, I take issue with that as a solution also. Well, let me just say that I have written extensively about this, and the caller pointed out that a lot of people are afraid to write about it. But E! Magazine, I've written probably 4 cover stories about population and immigration, and I've definitely not been afraid to address it as an issue. Basically, as a numbers issue, and to put it in any kind of racial context, it to me is extremely wrong. And there's a lot of racists who are seizing upon population issues, and I totally deplore that, and I make that very upfront in everything I write about it. But a number of the population groups, and the most prominent one is called zero population growth. It's now called the population connection. They even had a little trouble having the name zero population growth, so they changed it. But anyway, they totally focus on what you just said, which is empowering women, and they totally avoid the subject of immigration. And I think that's ideal, that you would empower women, and I do think that women have fewer children when they are empowered. But the actual, if you look with cold reality at what is happening with empowering women, the United States, in under the Bush administration, has moved us far backwards on that by linking all birth control to abortion and cutting back on availability of birth control aid wherever possible. Therefore, even though that would be ideal, the likelihood of that happening anytime in the near future, at least as long as Bush is still president, is virtually nil. So just saying that is your policy and then stepping back doesn't really move us forward at all. I don't think it does, because while it is a really good thing and it is ideal, it is not likely to happen, at least not right now.
Huh. Okay, and with that, let's go and talk with Rob in Fall River. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. Can you imagine, a few centuries ago, I used to run around with a lapel button saying ZPG on it, and so on as well on my my Levi's. One question, actually. Hydrogen. I believe that's all derived either through the fossil fuel, natural gas, you know, derived from that, or the energy is, you know, to get it from water is derived from the fossil industry. Is there...
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you could have electrolytic hydrogen from water that is basically powered by renewable energy like solar power or wind power. So then it's a completely clean energy loop. You don't necessarily have to involve the grid.
I guess then that would bring the next question. Is there some sort of either a formula or some way to determine the amount of energy going in to derive that bit of energy, BTU or...
Oh, yeah, because you have to look at it as what you would call a well-to-wheels type loop.
Okay.
You can't just talk about, the efficiency of the vehicle. Now, as it happens, fuel cell cars are probably twice as efficient as an internal combustion car. So they look very good that way, but you have to look at the total of how the energy was produced, how much it costs to transport it, whether it was a clean process, all these different things. And that is very much done. GM and other companies talk about that a lot. You talk about well-to-wheels, what the overall efficiency of it is. And I did quite a bit of analysis of that in a New York Times piece I did a couple of weeks ago. It's probably online now, sort of a Q&A on hydrogen and how it works. Right now, producing hydrogen costs $3 to $8 a gallon equivalent, so it's pretty high. But the cost of producing it from renewables is going down, actually, so that's encouraging.
Very good. Appreciate your time.
Sure.
All right. Thank you, Rob. Next we go to George in Madison. Hi, George.
Good morning, gentlemen. And the last gentleman just segued to my point, and I wanted to push a little harder on that. It's all good in the saying that we can make fuel cells out of wind and other solar, but the well or the ability to use that solar directly, to me, just seems to indicate fuel cells don't make sense. I'm going to take that solar and I'm going to drive my motors and my refrigerator directly. And we don't have enough solar to, displace all the electricity. So why would I want to make fuel cells out of coal, which coal or nuclear, to drive cars when I can use it? All of that I can use is going to be available or needed directly.
Well, one way of looking at it is that hydrogen is an energy carrier as opposed to energy directly. If you look at oil, you can just get it out of the ground and use it with a little bit of refining. But you have to put energy in to get hydrogen. It has to be separated from something else. So what it is an energy carrier like electricity or a battery, if you look at it that way. Therefore, when you talk about getting electricity or hydrogen from a renewable source, the problem is those sources are intermittent. Wind energy, for instance, is intermittent because the wind doesn't blow all the time. But when the wind is blowing, you capture that electricity and turn it into hydrogen. That gives you a way of storing it. That's one way of looking at it, because with electricity, you have to use it or lose it, and you have to use it at the point that it's generated unless you have a way of storing it, and batteries are not a very effective way of storing it.
George, thank you for your call. Nicole is in West Milwaukee. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. I heard that Sweden is no longer dependent on fossil fuel for autos.
That's a goal in Sweden. That's not something they've actually achieved.
Okay. I'm just wondering, how seriously are we looking at other countries for fuel alternatives? We're looking at other countries as models and taking their practices into consideration.
Well, Sweden's a real good example of looking at, because Sweden has about 9 million people and maybe 4.5 million cars, something like that. And, of course, that makes it a lot easier. But they're doing some really innovative things to try to get off fossil fuels. As I said, that's their goal. It's not that they've achieved yet. I mentioned earlier that they're importing ethanol from Brazil, made from sugar cane, and they're trying to set up their own ethanol industry using forest waste as the basis. And I think that's really cool. Whether they can meet their whole energy needs from forest waste ethanol, it seems a little dubious to me. But they also do things. They capture methane from landfills, and they make like a natural gas type product that also fuels automobiles. And both Saab and Volvo make cars that can run on these fuels. And there's a network. The great thing about a country like Sweden is with like 65 gas stations or something like that, you can pretty much reach the whole population. And, you know, another example of this would be Iceland, because Iceland, which I visited recently, is trying to become the world's first hydrogen-based energy economy. And they could do this probably with 10 hydrogen stations, making hydrogen from completely clean geothermal energy. And I think it's completely achievable in Iceland. It's a lot harder in the U.S. with 180,000 gas stations to get hydrogen, and also we're so much bigger, is to get hydrogen all around the country. It's a very difficult substance to move around because it's so light. Hydrogen is the lightest element, and it likes to leak out of things. And that's why when it's in a car, it's compressed to 10,000 pounds per square inch, which also takes a lot of energy.
The examples you just gave from other countries, are U.S. policymakers aware of these stories as you just laid them out? And as Nicole asks, are they being used as models or at least to inform the process here?
I would say no. I would say the U.S. Congress is generally not aware of what other countries like Sweden and Iceland are doing.
And on the other side of that equation, we talked earlier about the three levels. Oftentimes in other areas, welfare reform comes to mind. States have been encouraged to be laboratories for ideas and policy. Is that a good model to follow here?
Yeah, and I think you mentioned it earlier. Arnold Schwarzenegger in California is a great model for the Republican Party. He's certainly a lot better model than Bush. And I think if you look at California as a country, because it could be a pretty large country on its own, if you look at it that way, it's done a whole lot to reduce energy demand, even though its population has increased. Energy demand in California is basically a straight line, even though the population is, I don't know the exact figures of destination, but it's one of the biggest destination places of new immigrants. So its population is growing a lot and will probably double in like 50 years. But they've done so much with conservation of energy and convincing the population to conserve that they're not growing in their energy demand. And they're also the originator of the cleanest emission laws in the country that are now followed by about 14 other states. And all of this is very enthusiastically endorsed and effectively pushed by Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah.
Just a minute left in the program, and I want to ask you, I heard a commentator the other day say that he thought maybe 20 members of Congress total really understood the Iraq issue, and the others are just kind of following along and looking at polls. How would you answer that? How many members of Congress really get this issue?
Well, I would say it's probably about the same number as understand Iraq. And I would say that those 20 probably don't even understand Iraq. judging by the times when they were asked about the different factions, and they got all tongue-tied about it, trying to sort the Sunnis from the Shiites.
Right. But on climate change and energy issues, are there at least some people there who get it?
Yeah, there are. There are. I think there are. And I think they're the ones that have tended to push these new climate and energy bills. And I do think they have a better chance of passage in the new Congress. And the mood is certainly to get serious about climate and energy. And I do think the Bush administration is likely to veto any bills on climate or bills that they would perceive as not in the best interest of the oil industry.
And you know what? We've got to let you go. The hour's up. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. E-Magazine, eMagazine.com. Take a look.
Okay, eMagazine.com. Jim Motovalli is the editor of eMagazine. Thanks to Mimi Notstein for on-air production and to Rhonda Fanning, who produced the program. I'm Peter Donalds, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.